This is the second day of this June 2015 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday, the teachings of Yuan Wu. The title is Zen Letters, the teachings of Yuan Wu, translated by J.C. Cleary and Thomas Cleary. This is, of course, one of his letters. Ever since antiquity, with excellence beyond measure, the sages have experienced this great cause alone, planting great potential and capacity. They've experienced this great cause. The translator puts capital letters, G, capital G, capital C, this great cause alone. Which really means seeing beyond cause and effect. Seeing that which is beyond all such distinctions. By the power of their vows of compassion, they have brought forth direct indications of the one thing that is most profound and most recondite, the common essence of all the myriad forms of being. He's talking about deep realization. By the power of their vows of compassion. Sometimes it seems that we take this matter of compassion for granted, insofar as our practice will liberate, by and by, it will liberate our innate compassion. There are traditions where it's talked about more as something to work on, kind of making it a practice of compassion. I think this is true in some forms of Tibetan Buddhism. In Zen, it's implied that when we empty the mind, this liberates our innate compassion. There's nothing we have to we don't need to meditate on compassion if we can free the mind from the shackles that block our natural, innate flow of compassion. Here, in referring to the vows by these great masters, their vows of compassion, though, this is where we see it most prominently in Zen, is in the four bodhisattva vows. The first being most directly linked here, all beings without number I vow to liberate. One could get the impression from reading some Zen texts that these masters were, sure, they were strong and fierce and vigorous, even intimidating, but underneath that is this longing to help others out of suffering, this unnecessary suffering that stems from delusion, ego delusion. We don't in Zen so much wear our hearts on our sleeves. It's not as Harada Roshi in Japan used to say, it's we don't cotton to these powder and rouge kinds of expressions. But it's there. It's there, these great masters who labor their whole lives to not just to awaken themselves, but then to turn around and lead others and help others. He goes on, without setting up stages, they abruptly transcend to realize this essence alone. Well, to realize this mind is to see through stages. It's to see beyond evolving through practice. There is that. Yes, there are stages in one sense. There are differences between beginners and very seasoned practitioners. But in the other sense, there is no difference at all. All of us are equally endowed with this bright mind of enlightenment. Since before the time when nothing existed, this essence has been ever still and unmoved, determining the basis of all conscious beings. It permeates all times and is beyond all thought. It is beyond holy and ordinary and transcends all knowledge and views. It is never fluctuated or wavered. It is there, pure and naked and full of life. All beings, both animate and inanimate, have it complete within them. This Buddha mind, this true mind, this mind of awareness, I've read that one could understand the word Buddha as awareness. Of course, our fundamental awareness that goes beyond wake and sleep. There is a semblance of awareness, this fundamental awareness that we are all equally endowed with. This doesn't disappear in sleep. At the close of the daily schedule, each day in Sesshin, I recite this verse, which is even as night darkens the green earth, the wheel turns, death follows birth, strive as you sleep through the night, that you may wake past day, past death. Doesn't make sense logically. Strive through the night as you sleep. But there is this awareness, or our fundamental aspiration doesn't disappear when we go to sleep. We can get hints of this awareness that goes on undiminished through sleep. We can get hints of it in kind of mysterious things that happen even in sleep. One of my Dharma heirs, Amala Sensei, said that she found that when she was going to Sesshin here and she wanted to not waste time by sleeping too much, she would reach a point in the middle of the night, maybe, I don't know, let's say midnight, it doesn't matter, and that she would then decide, okay, I want to get up at 3 o'clock. I don't want to sleep more than 3 hours. And since in those days we were sharing rooms and you couldn't use any kind of alarm that would wake anyone else, she said when she was lying down, she would slam her hand against the pillow 3 times and that she would wake up at 3 o'clock. Now, there are some people I might question that as really something that is really true, but not with her. And I've heard other stories and even some little experiences like that myself, where there's something that beyond sleep in our ordinary conscious mind. When you think of Buddha, Buddha mind, as the mind of awareness that is constant at all times, and plug it in here, it makes an interesting paragraph. Since before the time when nothing existed, this awareness has been ever still and unmoved, determining the basis of all conscious beings. It permeates all times and is beyond all thought. It is beyond holy and ordinary and transcends all knowledge and views. It is never fluctuated or wavered. It is there, pure and naked and full of life. All beings, both animate and inanimate, have it complete within them. Well, the inanimate part doesn't seem right in this case to use the word awareness. There's nothing outside this Buddha mind, and that would also mean inanimate things. But in this rendering of the word Buddha as awareness, then it wouldn't apply to the inanimate. But otherwise, yes. We don't need to find our essential awareness anywhere. We have it. Have it, as he says, have it complete within us. Even to say within us is just reflects the limitations of language. It's strictly speaking, we can't say within because that suggests it's different from without. This awareness is us. This Buddha mind, this Buddha nature is us. If it were something we could have, then it would be something we could lose, and we can't. It's our nature. He continues, that is why when Shakyamuni Buddha was first born, he immediately pointed to the heavens and to the earth, and with a great lion's roar brought it right out in front. This, of course, is a fable that when the Buddha was first born, he took seven steps and did just that. Then, after he had left home and sought enlightenment for 6 years, he awakened at the sight of the morning star. In the end, on Vulture Peak, he initiated the Zen transmission by holding up a flower. All that was important is that we should possess the comprehension of this true I. Possess the comprehension of it. We all possess it. Just awakening to it. From the time of Shakyamuni, the true I was secretly transmitted through the 28 Indian patriarchs and the 6 Chinese patriarchs. Those who did not know of the existence of the true I of enlightened perception thought that there was some kind of supernatural power or magical ability involved, and just spoke of going along with the waves and pursuing the current, never searching out the root of the transmission. I think here he's probably referring to the Taoists. I thought that there was some kind of supernatural power or magical ability involved, and they just spoke of going along with the waves and pursuing the current. There's a very Taoist quality to it, of just merging, harmonizing with things as they are. This is, as I am, my very meager understanding of Taoism, although I don't know there's much to understand, actually, this would be one of the big distinctions between Taoism and Buddhism, or at least Zen Buddhism, is that I've never run across any reference to awakening, coming to enlightenment. It's a big absence from Taoism. He goes on, in general, when superior wisdom, excellent capacity, and natural potential are already there. It is just a matter of working to penetrate through surely and truly. When you put it to use, you command great potential and unfurl great function, moving even before any impulse to action, operating free of things. Moving even before any impulse to action. There's a research in neuroscience that pretty strongly shows evidence that we have this mysterious impulse that operates apart from the will. That if we will, let's say we decide that we're going to move a pencil in front of us, that the action actually begins a fraction of a second before the decision is made, the intention is made. It's just confounding how this can be, but that's what the research shows over and over again. And contrast this with the ordinary person who finds thoughts continually creating a gap between the genuine response or genuine impulse and the action. I'm thinking of this great verse by T.S. Eliot, between the idea and the reality, between motion and the act, falls the shadow. Between conception and creation, between emotion and response, falls the shadow. That shadow is what we can get rid of through Zen practice. It's the shadow of thoughts that diminish our experience of life, that obstruct our authentic functioning in life, between the emotion and the response. How many people have no never block an emotion that they feel? Between conception and creation, coming up with the idea and then following through with the actual creation of it. Between the idea and the reality. See, the aspiration to enlightenment and realizing that aspiration. What gets in the way? Thoughts. Not just little random thoughts that flit through the mind, but the whole conceptual mass that obstructs us. It's conditioning that's built up, where we flee into concepts and thoughts rather than just being fully, freely alive and responsive. And then he quotes another earlier master, Yan Tao, spurning things is superior, following things is inferior. Here the things would be thoughts. Spurning things is as rejecting or refraining from thoughts is superior, following thoughts is inferior. If we talk about battle, each one's strength is in the turning point. Each one's strength is in the turning point. Maybe this could be understood as our strength is in how we choose moment by moment when we find ourselves caught in thoughts, whether we choose to linger there or redirect the mind back to the practice. That's the turning point. We keep getting more chances to make the right decision. We keep having more tests of our resolve. Do you want to go on dwelling in your thoughts, or do you want to find a whole new way of living and relating to the world by turning the mind away from this gray world of thoughts back to the realm of no thought? That's when we come alive, no thought. He goes on, if you can turn fast on top of things, then everything will submit to you and everything will be in your grasp. Capturing and releasing, rolling up and rolling out, all can be transformed. At all times you remain peaceful and tranquil without having anything whatsoever hanging on your mind. In action you accord with the situation and its potential, holding the means of discernment within yourself, shifting and changing and successfully adapting, you attain great freedom. All things and all circumstances open up before your blade like bamboo splitting, all bending down with the wind. Here, of course, he's talking about the sense of mastery that comes from not falling prey to thoughts. It's in this realm of no thought that we are most adaptive, most flexible and responsive. It's these unnecessary thoughts that binds us from this fluid response to the world. Therefore, if where you stand is reality, then your actions have power. If where you stand is reality, reality would mean if you're present. If you're not lost in your thoughts, but you're present, awake, alert, then your actions have power. Needless to say, leading brave heroes, commanding fierce warriors, routing powerful bandits, comforting the farmers, pacifying the nation, and assisting the work of restoring social harmony and cultural florescence all depend on this one revelation. It may be that he's writing to some government official or maybe some leading general or something, that he picks out these particular examples. Turning the topmost key, achieving something that cannot be taken away in 10,000 generations, you see and hear the same as the ancient Buddhas and share the same knowledge and functioning. And then he quotes the great Dashan, Toksan is his Japanese name. A Buddha is just someone with no concerns. Nothing hanging in the mind. I would guess that here that Yuan Wu, the writer of the letter, is alluding to this longer statement of Dashan. If you have no concern in your mind, and no mind in your concerns, then naturally your mind will be empty yet numinous, calm yet sublime. If you have no concern in your mind, nothing hanging in the mind, no mind, and no mind in your concerns. Concerns, it might mean that there are problems that you face. Everyone faces problems, even Buddhas. But to face them without dwelling in thoughts about them, then naturally your mind will be empty, yet numinous. And then he quotes another master, Yung Chia. It is not apart from here, always profoundly clear and still. If you search for it, you know you cannot see it. You can't see it because it's not a thing to be seen. Apart from other things, there's a koan in the Blue Cliff Record where Yunmen or Ummon says, "Everyone has his own light, though when you try to see it, you cannot. Everything is darkness." That doesn't mean you can't realize it. In fact, it is in the darkness of not knowing, truly not knowing, this realm of no mind, that the realization comes. And then he quotes one other master, Linchi Rinzai, "The real being with no status is always going in and out through the doors of your face." This is probably what's been translated as a person of no rank. The real person, a person of no rank. Of course, our true nature. I'm going to skip a couple of letters and pick up in the middle of another one. "Once you merge your tracks into the stream of Zen, you spend your days silencing your mind and practicing with your whole being." Silencing your mind. This doesn't mean just sitting. You spend your days silencing your mind. That is, not feeding this mind of delusion, of thoughts. Silencing your mind and practicing with your whole being. You realize that this great cause is not obtained from anyone else, but is just a matter of taking up the task boldly and strongly and making constant progress. Day by day you shed your delusions, and day by day you enhance your clarity of mind. Your potential for enlightened perception is like fine gold that is to be refined hundreds and thousands of times. Just to go back to this, day by day you shed your delusions. I think a master once said, the practice of Zen is a practice of daily losing. Losing what is not essential to us, losing what gets in the way of our free functioning, losing our mental attachments. Day by day, year by year, sesshin by sesshin, you shed your delusions. It happens at a pace where we don't see it. And then some people can get discouraged. They don't see dramatic change. And this is where faith comes in. Even though you don't see much happening, if you have faith that something is happening, that there is change, there is a steady purification of the mind. And that just means purifying the mind just means getting free of mental attachments. If you have faith in that, that contrary to any overt evidence, that work is happening, that one is changing, one is evolving, then that faith will keep you going until you find confirmation of that change through the direct experience of your own true nature. Many people don't have quite enough faith in that, and so when they don't see results as quickly as they'd like to see them, then they can falter, even give up practice. But there is no question, if you persevere long enough, the change happens. Wonderful changes happen. And persevere doesn't mean just sitting 20 minutes every third day. It really means daily sitting, finding a way to fit this in every day. Then it's just a matter of time. He continues, what is essential for getting out of the dusts, what is basic for helping living beings, is that you must penetrate through freely in all directions and arrive at peace and security, free from doubt, and attain the stage of great potential and great function. Free from doubt. This is the great gift of even a first faint experience of awakening, is that it removes doubt. You still have years of work to do, lifetimes of work to do, but now it's on a different basis. Now there is no doubt that this works. There's no doubt about one's own nature, that one is not just filled with greed, anger, and delusion, and hopelessly struggling to realize something one isn't. But on the contrary, one is from the very beginning this enlightened. This is inexpressibly helpful in terms of maintaining this work, which is really what it's all about. Awakening is just a way to confirm one's nature so that one will go on forevermore. Until awakening, one is, to some degree, vulnerable because it hasn't been, one's nature hasn't been confirmed through direct experience. There is still an element of belief, even hope. But after awakening, there's no doubt. That's the way things are. That's the way one is. Whole and complete. With a mind of luminous awareness, fundamentally. And then it's just a matter of continuing to scour the mind and to reclaim what has always been ours. He continues, this work is located precisely in your own inner actions. Inner actions. Does he mean in your own mind, your own intentions, your own aspiration? It's hard to say. It is just a matter of being in the midst of the interplay of the myriad causal conditions every day, in the confusion of the red dusts, amid favorable and adverse circumstances and gain and loss, appearing and disappearing in their midst without being affected and turned around by them, but on the contrary, being able to transform them and turn them around. He's talking about daily life, all of the stresses and decision making and of daily life, in the confusion of the red dusts. I would take this to mean the passions. Red always suggests the passions. Blind passions are reacting to people and things. Without being affected and turned around by them. Without losing our center. Without being overcome by circumstances, without burning out. Zen Master Joshu said, most people are used by the 24 hours. I use the 24 hours. That may sound in the translation a bit egoistic, but we can be sure that when Joshu said it, probably in the original Chinese, it was not quite like that, and that wasn't what he was talking about. When you are leaping with life and water cannot wet you, this is your own measure of power. You reach an empty, solidified silence. But there is no duality between emptiness and form, or silence and noise. You equalize all sorts of wondrous sayings and perilous devices and absolute perceptions. Ultimately, there is no gain or loss, and it is all your own to use. There's no duality between emptiness and form, or silence and sound. On the level of words, of course, these are opposites. But to get beyond words, to get beyond thoughts and concepts, we see a realm in which these two are swallowed up. These two sides, emptiness and form, silence and sound, good and bad, right and wrong, this and that. All of these dichotomies only exist in words and thoughts. Not in mu. Not in true absorption in mu. Not in the questioning of anything. What is this? Who am I? In that total absorption, these things evaporate, these divisions of the mind. He finishes up this letter with, when you go on grinding and polishing like this for a long time, you are liberated right in the midst of birth and death, and you look upon the world's useless reputation and ruinous profit as mere dust in the wind, as a dream, as a magical apparition, as an optical illusion. Set free, you pass through the world. Isn't this what it means to be a great sage who has emerged from the dusts of sensory attachments? There's a wonderful passage here. This phrase is, you look upon the world's useless reputation and ruinous profit. So you see the whole matter of reputation, fame, disrepute, profit, loss, as just dust. It's a really exalted perspective, but it's within the grasp of everyone through long, intense zazen. We find that we our perspective on these and other things shifts on its own. We don't have to try to find a new perspective. Just through the absorption in the practice we're working on, steadfastly absorbing oneself, we see things differently. This is what brings people back to Sesshin again and again. Using vacation time to do so is this priceless shift in how we see ourselves and others and the world. This is the absolute most marvelous benefit of deep zazen. Doesn't have to be sesshin, but it invariably comes through long devoted sitting. This phrase, when you go on grinding and polishing like this, of course he's talking about sustained exertion over years and years. Made me think of a passage from Linchi Rinzai. Followers of the way, he who is a sincere student of Dharma must practice the way. Take me, for example. In bygone days, I devoted myself to the philosophical study of Buddhism. Later, when I realized that they were displays of doctrines in written words, I once and for all threw them away, and, searching for the way, I practiced zazen. It is not that I understood from the moment I was born of my mother, but that after exhaustive investigation and grinding discipline, in an instant, I knew of myself. So ironic that it takes all this hard work, sustained over years usually, this hard work just to realize that which we have always been. This place where we stand is the pure lotus land, and this very body, the body of Buddha. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.